This meeting is being recorded.
And hello, everyone, and thank you for joining the Interoperability Standards Workgroup. Just want to remind everybody, your feedback is always welcome throughout the meeting, which could be typed in the chat feature or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at about 11:55 Eastern time this morning. So I'm going to begin roll call of our workgroup members. So when I call your name, please indicate your presence. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Brian Malik.
Good morning.
Kelly Aldrich. Adele Briggs-Melanson. Hans Butenduck. Thomas Cantalina. Christina Caraballo. Grace Cordovano. Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Sanjeev Tandon.
Good morning.
Raj Gotwarti. Tim Jurgis. Ken Kawamoto.
Morning.
Leslie Leonard. Hung Lu.
Morning.
David McCauley.
Hello.
Glenn McDonald. Aaron Meary. Mark Savage.
Good morning.
Michelle Schreiber.
Morning.
Abby Sears.
Good morning.
And Ram Sharam.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Now, please join me in welcoming Stephen and Arian for their opening remarks.
As always, thank you, everyone, for getting up and getting going wherever it is that you are and joining us today. I know that some of the people who are not here with us, it is because they're fully engaged at HIMSS, which is a good thing for them. But we will adapt our plans for today's discussions accordingly based on who's here. I know Christina's caught up. For those who didn't hear, she's the new VP of informatics at HIMSS, which is pretty exciting. And Hans has been very busy. He told us he wouldn't be able to make it to join us this time as he was unable to last time. So we'll make the most of what we have here today. You're looking at the agenda, and we are going to jump in kind of where we left off and try to work through some more specific recommendations as quickly as possible, remembering that our time is short. We've reached out to a number of folks, including Hans and Clem and others, and asked them to come specifically to represent their recommendations. So Dr. Hung Lu in particular is going to give us a straight up focus early on regarding laboratory interoperability and the opportunities that he sees there. We're then going to turn back to Mark to kind of do a little bit of cleanup on some of the issues that we had left open last time, and then talk a bit about provenance author as a potential data element for our consideration. And then also, as we said, clean up some of the other open issues related to health status and assessments as we've been discussing. Aaron, do you want to add to that?
Let's get into it.
Jump right in. All right. And just as a verbal reminder to the members of the public who are joining us today, we do encourage your participation. You can do that through the chat, as well as at the last 5 minutes of our scheduled time, we will have a verbal public comment and invite you to participate there as well. So, Dr. Hung Lu, thank you. You're a relatively new member of our work group, and you've been making some really great suggestions regarding your area of expertise. You provided some slides regarding, go back one. Let me just, as part of the intro, regarding laboratory data class for specific data elements within that class that you wanted to comment on. You've entered that as we invited you to into the spreadsheet. So why don't you walk us through the changes that you're recommending and the reasons for them? And also, if we can, Al, pull up the rows in the spreadsheet as we go so we can make appropriate edits, that would be wonderful. And as you're doing that, I will say that Al made some additional changes to the spreadsheet. Specifically, we added entry numbers because you'll recall last time we had a little bit of a challenge with things being, you know, inserted or sorted or whatnot. So rather than going by line numbers, we're going to go by entry numbers, which are distinct. FYI on that.
Hey, before we dive into Dr. Liu's recommendations here, maybe a request to Al. Lab results, lab tests and results occupy the same position in USCDI as medications, where there is an absurdly complicated meatball, one might say, under a very simple heading. So in medications, we say medications coded by Rx norm. In laboratory, we say values/results. And then I don't even know that we say encoded by Loinc and Yukum. But, you know, again, we have this very, very complicated structure in lab. So I think we say overall lab is tests with applicable vocabulary standard of Loinc. Values and results, I don't think we mentioned SNOMED, specimen types and result status. So we've got a very simple conceptual structure. And as everybody knows who's dealt with laboratory results and tests and analytes and the whole complex beast, there is a ridiculous amount of complexity here. And I have the same question before we dive in and start adding elements to the lab category as I did when we started contemplating adding elements to the medication category, just a philosophical question relating to USCDI and how it measures or how it manages these very complex objects as effectively one-liners.
So Arian, I think that's a really important sort of orienting question. And I think that labs are quite different than meds, right? In the med space, for those of you who've been with us, you know, we were talking about what were all the data elements that would be required to really be able to meaningfully display a current medication list in a way that would make a difference to patients and providers and other stakeholders. With labs, we have struggled mightily with discrete lab integration and exchange. And we know the difference between being able to simply view a lab result from another organization versus being able to integrate it into our system and the levels of integration that might entail. So I think the issues are similar but different enough that we shouldn't say because we made this decision about meds that we should necessarily make a similar decision about labs. I think that there probably are some substantial marginal benefits that could be gained in lab data interoperability as we add on additional data elements within that class. So that would just be my perspective. And I think we may have some folks participating in the chat already who are weighing in on that as well. But I think it's a really good point and one we should.
Yeah, I just would love Al's sort of comment on the philosophy of USCDI from an ONC perspective when it comes to these really complicated hairy beasts. That, you know, what level of specificity we should and want to go down to. I don't know if is Al on?
Yeah,
I am.
Okay, go for it. Got it.
So I just in general, like clearly Arian ONC is aware of the potential complexity or the real complexity of each of these data classes and, you know, the decisions about how much detail, how much complexity to add to the core set of data required by EHRs is something that we revisit with each version of USCDI, with each versioning cycle. And, you know, where we've landed in the last three cycles is, you know, where we've stayed for the most part. There's some exceptions. We significantly expanded on other data classes, but that was to meet a specific need that was addressed by the submissions. So not to say that we couldn't expand just that we had considered it and had not in those examples.
All right, Hung.
All right, can I have the first slide, please? First, I'd like to thank the co-chairs for this opportunity to present on my rationale for including the above data elements into the USCDI version 3. My rationale comes from both personal experience and also my continuing work with the FDA SHIELD initiative, which is a public and private initiative to promote laboratory interoperability. Next slide, please. So I'd like to begin by highlighting some personal experience. And so in the early days of COVID, especially at our institution, there was a need to preserve personal protective equipment and to protect our hospital personnel in terms of being able to keep them safe while at the same time trying to safeguard limited resources such as N95 masks. And so what we came up with is a complex system of alerts and decision support in order to inform the providers as to what level of personal protective equipment they should wear when interacting with patients, especially in for admission and also for surgeries. We required testing for COVID and then the results kind of determined algorithm and determined what level of precautions they needed to take. And early on, one of the requests clinicians had of me is that they wanted to be able to accommodate patients coming from far distances by being able to integrate results from outlying sites into our EHR so that the results could be used to clear patients for surgery and admission, and also to trigger the appropriate decision support and what have you, if they were performed within 3 days of the either surgery or the admission. And so the way we accomplish that is there is existing functionality to be able to map these results into our EHR. Once they are fully mapped, they are indistinguishable from locally produced results and will perform in the exact same way as locally performed results in terms of triggering the appropriate result alerts and decision support. Next slide, please. So this is an example of the result that I would work with in order to try and determine if it should be fully mapped into our system. A result like this makes my life easier because number one, I know the specimen source and I know the platform that it was used on, performed on, because in this case, that's included in the comment. Without this information, I really could not determine if the test was comparable to what was locally performed, because that was extremely important to our providers and staff that any result that is mapped from an external source needed to be equivalent to what we were using for admission and surgical clearance. And so for me, a result like this is a godsend due to the fact that I know that a nasopharynx has the appropriate sensitivity versus if this was a anterior nares or a saliva or oropharyngeal sample, which would be unacceptable to our infectious disease team for clearance. In addition, I know the platform and know that this is a system that we ourselves use. And so this is definitely equivalent to what we are performing in-house. And so once it's clear, not only does it appear in the result view, but we also put this banner at the top so that anybody who's viewing the results know that this is equivalent to what we perform internally. Next slide, please. So unfortunately, only about 20% of results looked like the previous sample. This is what 80% of results look like. And so there is minimal information here. As a matter of fact, I can't even tell from the test name if this is actually a molecular PCR test or if this is actually an antigen test. And so this would be extremely problematic to try and map. In addition, I don't know the specimen. So I don't know if this was a saliva or anterior nares, or if this was And so this would be very difficult. If I make a mistake, that means that a child could potentially not have a necessary surgery because of a exposure to the anesthesiologist or the surgeon. And so obviously this is a duty that I do not take lightly. And so unfortunately I had to reject about 80% of external results due to the fact that they did not contain adequate information for me to determine equivalence. In addition, the results were often problematic, not for us, but for potentially for public health information areas, due to the fact that organizations represented the results in varying ways for qualitative results. So here we have negative a negative result. And in the previous example, we actually had not detected. And so, you know, if you are a human being looking at one result, we have an intuitive sense of what is represents positive and what represents negative. And so negative and not detected and non-reactive are going to pose little issue for us. But imagine if you are a public health lab and you are receiving thousands, if not millions, of results from different organizations, and they have elected to use different terms for representing the results. That can be very problematic. You either have to invest in human beings sorting through the results to determine what constitutes a positive and a negative result, or you have to develop complex translation tables and take into account all the possible permutations for these results and then to map them to either a positive or a negative result. We can solve this issue up front if we mapped these results to a standardized ontology such as SNOMED CT. So next slide, please. So I'm going to switch gears and talk about quantitative results. And so what I'm showing here is actually data from proficiency testing. So as part of the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act of 1988, all laboratories, if they perform non-wave testing, have to enroll in a proficiency program, a testing program. So what that is about 2 to 3 times a year, a manufacturer of proficiency testing samples will send known quantities of an analyte to different laboratories and have them perform it on their test and report it back to the proficiency testing provider. And then the proficiency testing provider would then grade the laboratory against their peer group, which is the same group of laboratories that use the same instrumentation. The reason we have to divide them into different peer groups and the same group performing on the same instrumentation is that even though these are aliquots off of the same sample with the same quantity of analyte in them, the results that are produced from the different platforms can be radically different. And this can be accounted for in terms of the units of measure. But if you look, what I'm highlighting here is that even within the same group that are using the same unit of measure, we are seeing radically different. And so the exact same sample is producing a result of 0.771 in one peer group and 2.109 in a different peer group. And the reason for this is there is variation in instrumentation. And that has to be accounted for. And so therefore, this is the reason that we break it up this way. And next slide, please. So what I'm showing next here is the Loinc code for fibrin D-dimer with a fibrin equivalent unit in platelet poor plasma by immunoassay. And so this is the Loinc code for this particular class of tests. And so all the tests below would qualify for use of this Loinc code and would be appropriately mapped to this Loinc code. But again, if you look at it, I would argue that these are not all the same tests. For one, we have two different units of measure that fall under the same Loinc code. And even within the different units, there are variations in in the results. And so using the LOINC code to determine equivalency would not be appropriate for this class. And in addition, that's why I'm suggesting that we need to include instrumentation and kit information in the USCDI version 3 in order to provide laboratories with the data they need to determine equivalency. And also, we have to consider downstream uses for laboratory data also. Currently, a lot of the instrumentation at my institution, which is a children's hospital, would be considered off-label use by the FDA because they were not FDA cleared in children. And the reason for that is that children are a protected population. And in some cases, the manufacturers have chosen not to submit the data required to get it cleared in the pediatric population. Not because it wouldn't work in that population, but because that is an added expense. And so one movement that the FDA is using is to move towards use of real-world evidence in order to be able to perform post-market surveillance and also to potentially expand initial indications to other populations that may not have been evaluated in the initial clearance. And so this to me is a health equity issue. And also for a post-market surveillance, you have to be able to know what instrumentation you're comparing to in order to make any kind of assessment. And so the test kit and instrument information is essential. Next slide. So this also has ramifications for clinical interoperability due to the fact that, again, clinicians would like to be able to compare results and be able to have a complete history of the patient's lab testing, no matter where the testing is performed. And so we do try to map externally generated results into the EHR for the patient. And this is the view that most clinicians will use. This is called a result view for a particular vendor. But the beauty of it is that you can consume a lot of information in one screen, and you can trend and see results as they change over time. The downside of this is that there's limited real estate. And so obviously you have to suppress some essential information, such as potentially reference range and other information, such as the fact that it was performed at a different laboratory. Next slide, please. The practical implications of that is that if I make a mistake and map an external result based solely on the LOINC code, without knowing the limitations of that, and without knowing the kit and instrument information, I could inadvertently map the result from an external lab that produces radically different results onto the same line as my locally produced D-dimer. In this case, the D-dimer is used to determine the likelihood of a patient having a venous thrombosis. The implications of a high or a positive result above the breakpoint is that the patient could undergo additional imaging to determine the source of the deep venous thrombosis, and they could undergo additional laboratory testing to determine, and they could undergo prophylaxis treatment for with heparin to try and stop the clot. So this should be of interest to CMS, because if this mistake is made, the patient could undergo unnecessary testing and unnecessary treatment and unnecessary imaging for a clot that potentially does not exist. And so as a laboratorian, I'm deathly afraid of making this mistake. And I know other institutions are as well. And so I know Dr. Raj Dash is in the audience. And at his institution of Duke University, he's informed me that they have a committee of four clinicians and laboratorians that spend hours on each analyte they plan to map into their EHR. And the reason they have to do this is because the information is limited and they have to thoroughly vet each one to make sure that they gather adequate data, including contacting the original institution that produced the result to determine what platform it was performed on. And in order to make sure that this mistake doesn't happen, along with all the potential implications for that.
Well, thank you, Hung. That was very helpful. Do you have any more slides to go through?
We can go to the last slide.
Okay.
And so what I'm proposing is that in order to make Clinder interoperably available to everyone, information needs to be available to the laboratory. And that includes not just the name of the test, but also information on the specimen, source and type, also the instrument platform and the same test kit. I wanna use the analogy of building a house. So, you know, we're told that if you wanna move a light socket, it's very easy in the design phase. But once the structure is up and everything's in place, moving a light socket a few inches to the left is a monumental task. And so what I'm proposing is that this committee is involved in the design phase of clinical interoperability. USCDI is central to that. And so none of what I've posed can't be fixed on the back end. It just involves a lot of money. And also, I don't know how many community hospitals would have the resources of an academic medical center in order to make sure that the results are adequately vetted. And so what they're going to do is either they're not going to map these results, or they're going to do the best they can with the information they have and potentially make mistakes and produce patient harm, neither of which is acceptable outcomes to me. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much. Aaron, you want to comment?
I do. So again, I'm very publicly struggling with what to do here. It seems to me, it seems to me hard to add test kit to USCDI test result when we don't have, for example, reference range as a data element under test result. I guess that's sort of conceptually where I am, we don't actually have the numeric or qualitative result in test result. If I take USCDI at face value as an ontology of data, all I've got is that a test was resulted with this LOINC code. If I interpret USCDI to be shorthand for an underlying ontology, then where I think we want to go is more specify the underlying ontology rather than adding specific data fields or data elements. One of the other commentators pointed out that that CLIA has a specific, not quite an ontology, but a specific implied data set that's required for validation. The direction that in my head we should be going is point USCDI to the underlying ontologies or underlying representational things that define what a result is. With respect to clinical interpretation for interoperability, that defines the constraints under which a test result should be communicated for the purposes of interoperability. And I would prefer to go in that direction rather than go in the direction of specifically adding, for example, test kit, when, as I noted, we don't actually have the numeric test result or have the reference range associated.
Thanks, Arian. And I wanna put a time bound around this discussion because we could easily spend the entire meeting on this. I would challenge the notion that we don't have the actual result because we do have values results as a data element already in USC at DIV2. And you mentioned the absence of reference range. And as far as I can tell, I don't see that at all, you know, in the USCDI as a submitted data element, which is interesting. I put my thoughts in the public chat, so I won't spend a lot of time reiterating them. I'm going to ask Clem and Ike to comment, and then I'm actually going to recommend we close discussion on this topic and move on, and then come back to pick it up again next week. Clem? Clem, are you audio? You're on mute. We can see from our end.
It's tough to get these items into the processes, but I'd like to ask a specific question. So the line codes with the cooperative activity by the FDA, CDC, and the industry, every COVID test, as it became accepted, was put into a structure called LIDD and publicized within 3 or 4 days of their availability. So I'm just curious to why, and they had specimen in them when the vendors, manufacturers, and CDC agreed on that. So I was just curious why it wasn't helpful to the process that you're working on. And the other thing is, when you talk about the D-dimer, were you distinguishing the DDU from the FEU units because they're different tests and clearly will be way different?
Yes, I was I was on the slide of the link. All of those were FEUs, and so wow. I did not include the D-dimer, units in there. And Clem, in the June 4th Department of Health and Human Resources requirements, yes, they did include assessment information, but they also included a unique device and kit identifier. And there was pushback from the laboratories about this, not because we disagreed with their inclusion, but because we knew that there was insufficient functionality in the LIS and EHR systems to capture and transmit this information. So okay. This was information that was considered vital by the Department of Health and Human Resources, but the laboratories could not capture it and could not transmit it to public health labs. And so that's an issue. So I don't think that we can afford to wait on this due to the fact that we have government requirements to include things that are not currently supported by our current technological ecosystem.
Okay, thank you.
Ike, last comment on this, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you so much. I will be as brief as I possibly can be. First, I think we probably need to re-examine or re-reconcile laboratory results from labs to hospitals and laboratory reporting from laboratories to public health, because things like test kits are included in the standards for reporting laboratory results to public health. And if there's a miss there or a disconnect, that's something that we can probably relatively easily address, because we're definitely requiring it on the other side. The second component of that one is looking at the relationship or any relationship between USCDI and what might be USCDI Prime or some, or USCDI Plus or whatever it's going to be labeled down the line. I want to parking lot that issue, but I think it does relate as to what does USCDI Plus end up looking like as to whether it's use cases or something else. I think that there are some opportunities that have not been well explored in that space to have great alignment between the USCDI and whatever the other thing is, and not create a bunch of confusion about, oh, is a data element in the USCDI and or the Prime. I think there's an easy approach to resolve that, happy to work on it. And the other component of that one is we're looking at routing data and including things and expectations on laboratories as potential middlemen or middle entities in providing care services. We do need to be cognizant of what additional burden we're creating on the labs for data that they can't really use for any particular purpose. such as, you know, it doesn't really make a difference to the laboratory in most cases if I went to Aruba last week in terms of their processing the test sample from a pure business end of it, but we're finding that they have to spend a lot of effort in modifying their LIMS to include that information because they're serving as a pass-through entity to get that data to the next step. And again, as a parking lot issue, are there better ways of doing that, maybe leveraging HIEs or rerouting those laboratory orders so that we're not ending up with what's effectively orphan data or data that's irrelevant to somebody that's receiving it?
Thank you, Ike. I really want to thank the subject matter experts who've taken the time to submit public chat comments. We will include all of those in the notes from this meeting. We will try to turn those notes around as quickly as possible and get them out to folks before the weekend, hopefully, so that you can review those in anticipation of our further discussion of this next Tuesday. I want to point out that ONC did include two additional data elements in draft USCDI V3 in this laboratory category. V2 includes just test and values results. Draft V3 also includes specimen type and result status. The specific recommendation here is to take a couple of additional data elements from the level 2 for laboratory and also bring them forward into V3. And I think our relatively simple and bounded challenge is to identify which additional data elements that have been leveled at level 2 warrant being brought forward into USCDI version 3. And with that, Arianne, do you want to add anything before we move on?
No, I think the comment that I put in the chat really covers it.
Terrific. Again, we'll try to get all the chat comments copied and out to everyone for review. And thank you all for your participation. Thank you, Dr. Liu. All right. The next areas we're going to turn to all are things that Mark Savage has spent a lot of time thinking about. And I've asked him to kind of tee them up. Mark, I'm sure you have an order in mind, but we are going to try to look at health status, sex and gender, health insurance, and provenance author, I believe. If we can get through as many of those as possible, that would be great. How would you like to proceed? Looks like author is what's on the slide deck.
Sure, I can go in whatever order you'd like.
I think whatever so you, start... I know you've given it a lot of thought. So you tell us what row, okay. what entry item you want to start with.
Why don't we start with 53? I'll pick up on your comment at the beginning of this hour too, that there was a little bit of cleanup. We covered sex assigned at birth last time, but on row 53, there was also a recommendation about the gender that Abby and I put forward about the, and Arian supported as well, about the Gender Harmony Project's proposal. So entry 53, we're strongly recommending alignment with the Gender Harmony Project framework and the five data elements: gender identity, sex for clinical use, recorded sex or gender, name to use, pronouns, and the value sets, those five elements work together collectively to represent sex and gender diversity for better care and outcomes for gender marginalized people. There's a slight tweak on the Gender Harmony Project's presentation to us on February 8th around gender identity. You'll see in row 53 that the four elements listed under Gender Harmony Project, gender identity, we're recommending keeping two additional ones from USCDI, additional gender category or other, please specify and choose not to disclose. And I've been in consultation with folks at the Gender Harmony Project and looked at some of the drafts on their website, and they too are drafting a proposal that would do just this, that would keep these two additional items from USCDI, so for the six collectively. Lastly, as the Gender Harmony Project recommended, would recommend that gender identity be in the patient demographics data class, name to use and pronouns there as well. Sex for clinical use, recorded sex or gender might be clinical values as well. So recommending that, and this area sort of tees up a little bit with the provenance and author item to come, that we track the source of the value and the method of capturing it. So with that as a broad summary, maybe I should pause in the interest of time.
Al, can you get us up to or over to column A? Okay, good, you can. All right. So what I did, if there's any way for people to scroll down to the bottom part of that column, it's tough because there's a lot of text there, so it's not displaying well. Let me do this. I'm going to temporarily cut out the stuff that we've talked about before. There we go. And now we can see what it is that Mark is talking about. And I'll put it back when we're done. So the recommendations then, Mark, just to be clear, additional. So say it again. Say specifically what you'd like to add to the recommendation.
Align with the Gender Harmony Project's proposal that we saw on February 8th, which was the four that you've now cut out, which is fine. But to keep from USCDI B2, the two additional ones that are in gender identity in USCDI B2, and as I mentioned, I understand that the Gender Harmony Project and work since February 8th is drafting up the same recommendation anyway. But that's not a guarantee. That's just my understanding.
Any comments, questions, objections to that suggestion?
Help me understand. Did you add in sex for clinical use post this recommendation? Because you know, I believe that USCDI right now is teed up to better specify gender identity and sex assigned at birth, and that sex for clinical use should be a future element that we'd want to contemplate, but we don't have sort of the runway to add sex for clinical use.
So to your first question, Arian, yes, this recommendation has always mentioned the five data elements at the at the beginning. Doesn't change your second question. I did some checking around. I find this is not my primary area of expertise, but I do find LOINC codes and fires and work on the HL7 fire specification for sex for clinical use, also for recorded sex or gender. Those are also outlined in the two articles that are linked there from the Gender Harmony Project and under the justification for recommendation that's been there for a while. Others may have something to add on that, but I did poke around and did find that work. I can drop some of that in the chat if you wish.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we have any interoperability on the ground that is appropriately. And again, this recommendation from Gender Harmony is also the same recommendation that came from, and Al, correct me, the federal report that we were looking at previously. You know, the notion that we should be treating biological sex only in context of the clinical decision that is being made. It is a consistent recommendation. This is just an area where I think we're going to need to do work on the ground before we're able to contemplate. First of all, I don't know that sex for clinical use can be in USCDI because sex for clinical use almost definitionally has to be an interoperability specific data element because it is not a thing. It is something that is specific to, for example, a radiological exam or specific to a lab result. And you know, for many people, it may be the same thing, but for some people, it may need to be tailored and specific for the specific procedure, test, et cetera, that wants to be performed. And so it may be malleable and context specific.
That was what we heard from the Gender Harmony Project. And I think the framework that they gave us envisioned that the codes would be used, and actually the values might be different for a test or a procedure, but that the coding was there.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, so are we ready to accept this? It'll need to be reworded, and we're not going to try to do the wordsmithing here in real time, as a work group decision that will turn into a recommendation to the HITECH. Anybody object to that based on this discussion? All right, so we have a decision to include, accept and include, and we will work on the wordsmithing for that between now and the next meeting. Okay, Mark, where do you want to go from here?
Thanks very much. Let's go to provenance then, please, which is 65, if memory serves.
Provenance for 100?
No, I'm going to go for 200, please. So this is a level two data element, and provenance is a data class. Author is the data element, and recommending that data element be added to USCDI v3. We've already had discussions on this work group about the importance of sorry, this is jumping. I'm going to go to my own version so I can just stay focused. The importance of this element for self-reported data that's critical, race, ethnicity, gender identity, disability status, pregnancy status, all proposed for V3 and capturing the difference between whether this is a self-reported value, which is important for some federal standards, especially race and ethnicity, or whether it's a clinical value, or even whether it's another source. In a meeting a while ago, I mentioned my own investigation, which found that sometimes you could have a race ethnicity value that had been self-reported or clinically observed, but overwritten by a batch file. So keeping track of that provenance is really important, and really important for health equity here to know how the person self-identifies. So, there are also some examples of level two data elements that show how important this could be. Family health history, the thing that we all fill out in the room. Problem, the date of onset, allergies, travel information, for example, with COVID and Zika. So I've listed some V3 elements, some level two data elements that at the very least would be really helpful to have this level two provenance author data element with, and that would be my recommendation that we raise author up to USCDI V3 for those reasons. I will just add that the Social Security Administration, which was the one that submitted it, gave a pretty compelling example of how 3 million disability applicants really needed this result too. Thank you.
So the suggestion is to add author. If you will look down at the bottom of the justification, that last sentence is something that I included and I will speak to, which is that discussing the challenge of adding the author to provenance with EHR vendors, I have come to appreciate that there could be a lot of work here in specifying what it means to be the author of any given data element. For example, a diagnosis on a problem list or a medication on a medication list. You know, is the author the original person who entered it? Is it the last person who modified it? Does this require the entire chain of modifications for a data element over time? It can be difficult. So one way to consider this would be to do it in a limited way. adding the element to simply specify if the data source was the patient or a caregiver versus a clinician or other care team member, as opposed to specifically address this issue of patient-generated data and differentiating it, as opposed to going all the way down to the individual. So I throw that out for consideration as well. Any thoughts?
David has an interesting comment on source versus author. I wonder if David could comment on that.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking on my feet here. I haven't looked into this, but many times you get data through an indirection that would not let you know who the actual author was, but you know the class of the author. It's a system, or it's a patient, or it's self-reported. So maybe a working notion might be for some of these fields where, to take Stephen's idea of a gentle start, is maybe consider it to be source instead of author. Go ahead.
Clem, I think, has also thrown some support for the idea. The trick is, and I'll ask Al to comment, that author is level at level two, source is leveled at level one, and author role is leveled as a comment. And each of these individual data elements was suggested by different stakeholders with a different use case in mind. I don't know that we can say, no, let's use source from level one instead of author from level two. I don't know that Al and ONC would let us get away with that. So I think if we're going to do this, we need to kind of call it author because that's what it was leveled as, and then perhaps make the recommendation that it be implemented in a limited way initially. Al, can you comment?
Can I add one thought, Stephen?
Sure.
Which is the... as author, that's especially important when you're considering self-reported data elements that are up there. I think source may be broader, as we saw from the Gender Harmony presentation. So it may be, the birth certificate may be the source of the information, but somebody might have actually been the author of that information.
Yeah, I think, David was thinking about the opposite side of this, where the source is a patient self-reported narrative, but the author could well be somebody transcribing that into an EHR. But again, as long as we agree what we mean when we say the word author, then include the source of the information under the definition of author, then we might be okay.
Sorry to interrupt, Stephen and Al.
So, Stephen, to answer your question, it's possible for we have in the past, and we might well in the future, take a given data element with a given definition, and make changes to it to make it more applicable across multiple different use cases. And so, that could involve changing the scope of either. Any of those three that you mentioned, author role, or source, changing the scope to better meet these broader set of use cases. And so I haven't looked deeply into the other ones besides author to see, like, why is it a comment? Why is it level one? It could be because it was just very narrowly defined, or it could be because there's no mature standards or it's not been exchanged as much. So depending on which of those it is, the things can be modified to meet a broader use case. So that could mean it could include something like changing the definition or the scope of author to make it a little bit more nonspecific. So it could be closer to an author role if the intent is to capture things like patient recorded data, patient informed data, or provider or system. So those are some options that could inform the recommendations. It could also inform how ONC interprets the recommendations.
Well, I've been trying to capture this in the spreadsheet as we go. There's also some useful input coming in through the public comment. There seems to be a general embrace of this idea of trying to use this initially to capture this notion of patient-sourced data. Arian?
Yeah, so I wonder whether the issue here is that we have something called author organization, and we may, to Al's point, the minimum surgery here may be to rename that field from author organization to author/source. And define that the author slash source could include the patient or individual or organization.
Al, what do you think of that idea?
That's a different recommendation than what we've been discussing so far and what's come in through the submission system. So, I mean, we can, that could be as a separate recommendation, because author organization has been in place since CDI version 1, and it's now, it's currently being enforced as is. And I'm not familiar with the test data around author organization, but that's an already established thing. So the impact changing an existing data element would be different than the impact of adopting a new one.
Okay. Again, don't want to burn more time on this than necessary. Does anyone object to us trying to craft a recommendation to add author to the degree necessary to be able to identify data that is sourced from the patient or a caregiver outside of the, separate from members of the healthcare team, if you will. And that's always tricky, of course, because we consider caregivers part of the healthcare team, so we'll have to get the language right. But does anyone object to this becoming part of our work? Okay. Mark, where do you want to go next?
I think the next one, not sure what you may have, but maybe 26, disability status, mental function and functional status. So this is a comprehensive recommendation. I pulled together some of the different things from our presenters at DREDF. I talked with them about whether this collective recommendation sort of captured everything that they were saying, and they thought that it did. So recommending the inclusion of the three data elements. The last meeting we just talked about disability status, so we hadn't really talked about functional status. Excuse me, we talked about mental status. And there was a question about the name, but we didn't talk about disability status and functional status. So this is a collective recommendation to include all three in USCDI, be through consistent with the presentation for disability status, that it go into the patient demographics data class, and that it use the 7 questions that our presenters reported to us. So it's the 6 questions from the American Community Survey used by the US Census, plus the 7th question on communication issues from the Washington Group on Disability Statistics, functional status and mental function, or I'm gonna get to some nomenclature in just a second, would remain in the health status data class. Again, to our conversation we just had, all the disability status will be self-reported, but functional status and mental function might be self-reported, or there might be a clinical observation. So author is an important thing there. As we've been discussing, recommending that we add source and the method of collecting the value. Perhaps the provenance author discussion will take care of that. And also adding that we recommend some work in the near future to incorporate, but not ready for USCDI V3 right now, but that we recommend work in the new future on 5 other categories of questions: learning disability, mental health disability, autism, social disability, healthcare accommodations, and caregivers' disability status. and also the data element on accommodations, which was, I believe, at level one, if memory serves. But as our discussion with our presenters highlighted, that work, sort of improving outcomes, was really important. Then in closing, to capture, I took on some homework at the last meet on Tuesday's meeting. I did talk with the presenters. They affirmed that disability status is the nomenclature that they recommend using, fine to use. They did recommend functional status and cognitive status rather than mental function as wording for the other two data elements. I think I've captured everything in the interest of time.
Arian?
Yeah, so I believe the last meeting on Monday, what we talked about was that we should add disability status as an assessment, and that we should contemplate that the disability status, as an assessment, should have a minimum vocabulary, which would include the ACS Washington Group survey. I also thought that we discussed last on Monday that the disability status is more like a vital than it is like a demographic, in the sense that demographics are or want to be permanent or semi-permanent characteristics, whereas vitals are important observations that can and do change. And where the change is important and material to clinical care. And I want to sort of characterize that I think in the space of a few days, we've had discussion that has at least encompassed both of those positions. I clearly have a preference for the assessment approach, but I just want to note that we talked about this a couple days ago, rather than being in demographics as being an assessment, and rather than specifying a particular instrument, specify that it is an assessment with multiple instruments with a value set that's inclusive of the ACS Washington Group instrument.
Mark?
I did check with the people at DREDF about that. They did strongly recommend that it be in demographics. The one of the things that they pointed out that I hadn't realized is it even has implications for clinical workflows, that often those questions get asked in the patient registration, and that this is outside my swim lane, but that for some reason that works better, significantly better as a demographics item than it does as a clinical item, which I think they were saying assessments was viewed in the internal workflows was viewed more that way. The other thing I'd say is if we're thinking of if the placement in a data class depends upon whether it's static or dynamic, this is going to be an issue for a variety of things. So and gender identity is not static either. My instinct here is that whether it's static or changes, it shouldn't really be the driver, but where it really belongs. And the advice I've heard is that disability status should be in patient demographics. So just sharing.
And just to be clear, yeah. In a certain sense, it doesn't matter. We shouldn't spend a lot of time on this. Getting the data element into USCDI is what's going to change the world. which class it's filed under really doesn't matter. So I would encourage us to not spend a lot of time on this and just do what's most expeditious. You did ask the key question in your recommendation as to whether the method, source and method of collecting needed to be sort of specified as a data element or subdata element or metadata related to this element, or whether, as we've just discussed, that can be captured under the provenance data that would travel with this. And it seems to me that we've had a number of conversations about the importance of identifying the source of data. And if we can get our provenance author recommendation right, we shouldn't need to then have it as an add-on to this or any other data elements in the US CDI. Al, can you comment on that?
I think I think that there's certainly the potential to have provenance data elements applied. I mean, the new provenance data elements or existing provenance data elements would apply to all of that, all that information about the collection method. I mean, it's a sort of a proxy for a collection method. And if the work group wants to recommend that a particular collection method, which would actually be the first time except for labs that the collection method is specified or identified. But if the work group wanted to make that recommendation, they're certainly welcome to.
Any other questions on this?
Yeah, this is Steve Eitner.
Go ahead.
On a couple of points. I think looking at perhaps the word evaluation rather than status might split that term in terms of being more reflective. It doesn't, to me, make sense for it to be included in the demographics class in the USCDI as we look towards the potential future of the USCDI, where there may be other elements related to disability condition. And it makes sense to me to have down the line all the related elements in the same class. So I'm not jumping between classes trying to find all the reasonably related data points. And if we drill down a little bit further, kind of real world example, my health condition is not my disability. My health condition is a particular diagnosis code that it happens to be a particular disease. The disease actually can impact my disability status, but it's not my disability status. The particular condition I have is progressive, and it progresses differently in different people. And the way the coding schemes are designed right now, it doesn't reflect, or the coding scheme doesn't reflect the progression of the disease in anybody, let alone in a consistent fashion across the patient population. So that, yes, I have the condition, and whether my left arm is locked, my right arm is locked, frozen, immobilized with HO, that differs in every person. And that's not necessarily, and that doesn't describe what my functional limitations may be in terms of saying, oh, there's been HO on my left shoulder. That doesn't convey whether it's, oh yeah, I've lost 20% of movement or 99% of movement. Those different levels have different values and reasons and utility in the healthcare environment. Understanding all of that at different points may be terribly relevant or terribly useful. So that if I'm looking at, oh, what's the accommodation I need to get into the office? The receptionist doesn't necessarily need to know that I've got 20 degrees of motion left or 2 degrees left for certain purposes. But again, how do we create this longer scale framework and organize our data up front so that we've got the capacity to grow in a logical manner? I don't think we need to get it all in one fell swoop down the line, but having it as a structured approach makes sense. And again, I love to come back and see both structured and unstructured data supported in this iteration so that we've got the capacity to include, whether it's patient produced or physician care team produced, evaluation or assessment of my ability or disability status in my record for coordination of care across my healthcare providers and care team, so that I'm not describing what my needs are for an accessible van in the same language for the 12th time. That's a real world example. And we're bouncing it around between four different systems, and nobody has a way of storing it as an attachment to my file. So it's been lost four times, resent five times, and it's just a pain, to be honest about it.
So I want to get us clear so that we can move on if possible. I think we decided last time, and anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, that we were going to refer to mental and cognitive status as opposed to mental function. Was that everyone's recollection? Yes. Okay.
Stephen, that may be, I'm just pointing out that there was a preference in my discussion with our presenters for cognitive status rather than mental status. If that's the pleasure of the work group.
Yeah, and I think that what the work group suggested was to add it as opposed to replace it. So if we can tolerate that, we'll go mental and cognitive status. And maybe we'll use the slash because and sort of implies perhaps something different. And then the other key component in our recommendation is, and again, I don't personally think it's worth us specifying which data class this goes into. I think we can acknowledge the discussion and the various views about that and the potential implications and leave that up to ONC. Does anyone feel differently, Mark, you or anyone feel that it's really worthwhile throwing our weight behind which class this data element goes into?
I'm fine with that. There's a lot on our plate.
Okay, so we will discuss the issues. Okay. And then the other part of this is the issue of being able to capture the method and source of collection. So I think that's critical. And it sounds like we can do that in a generic way as opposed to necessarily having to do that for each individual data element. So I think we can call that out here. Are there any other key components that we want to be sure we capture in our recommendation around these data elements and this data class? Okay, well, let's, again, I'm hoping that between now and next week, the co-chair leads, co-chair and work group leads can work on the actual wording for this and come back with something meaningful. I'm looking forward to a busy weekend. All right, then let's go on. Did you want to go to health insurance next, Mark?
I can, or pregnancy status, whichever you prefer.
Oh, I didn't know we needed to go back to pregnancy status. Why don't you, your choice.
Okay, so but, why don't we go to pregnancy status, which I believe is entry 27. So again, the work group last year, the USCDI work task force last year recommended this as a priority. I strongly recommend that we in turn recommend its inclusion in USCDI V3. I did point out sort of two levels of possible augmentation. One, at the very least, to capture the intent to become pregnant, because that has implications, significant implications for clinical care. This is not my area of domain expertise. I have talked to some people and the timing and where one is around pregnancy, actually, there are much there's much more than just the intent to become pregnant that's really important here. So, for example, in the postpartum session, that's when you have the greatest maternal mortality. And so capturing timing for purposes of better care at particular stages is really important. I don't, so I captured that in the recommendation that I think that's important, but I don't know where we are in the stata, in the stage of having established value sets that we can use. At the very least, I think augmenting to include the intent to become pregnant. Right now it's just yes, no, and unknown, as far as I can tell.
And just to be clear, within pregnancy information, pregnancy status itself is listed as level 2, and there are quite a number of additional data elements that have been submitted and are at the comment level, which does not include, as far as I can tell, intent or the data set that you just described. So, Al?
I just wanted, excuse me. I just wanted to remind everybody that the original intent of pregnancy status was to capture the risk pregnancy may have on other conditions or what other conditions may have on pregnancy. In the specific use case for pregnancy status that led to this was the screening that needs to occur prior to evaluation or during the evaluation for Zika. So that was a particularly acute issue back during the Zika epidemic. And so the simplicity of this data element at the time and since, and why it's in here now, or why it's being, why it was elevated to draft B3 is to capture that relationship of the possibility of being pregnant which could drive care depending on what the possibility is. I can see how not just during pregnancy, but at a particular stage of pregnancy, there might be an increased risk or decreased risk depending on, you know, what it is that's under consideration. I'm just saying that some of this recommendation is, I think, significantly altering the original scope of pregnancy, the pregnancy status data element. Not to say that the recommendation shouldn't be made. I'm just pointing out that it's a fairly significant shift from the original intent of this. There could be other data elements where would be closer to the intent of this recommendation. So I'm not saying don't make it. I'm just saying it's sort of the background behind the original data element.
I think that's really helpful, Al. And I think, you know, we all always have to remember that perfect is the enemy of good, and that this is an iterative process, and that adding this, you know, I think it would be hard to argue against the value of adding this to V3, as has been suggested in the draft V3, whether it makes sense to try to ask for more or to provide some additional guidance. I mean, this is a simple enough value set, but what we have no information about whether it is currently collected or exchanged or anything else. So I think it may be a value set that needs to make its way through the process. Through a submission specifically or through public comment. And when I look at pregnancy status, you know, on the site, there are some public comments, but it doesn't look like it includes that in particular.
So I also wanted to mention, Stephen, that the reason that we did not define a value set or a set of example codes is because there's a very wide range. If you look at value sets around pregnancy status, there's a very wide range of options, a number of options. Some value sets state every conceivable complication related to pregnancy, and there's, you know, at least dozens, if not hundreds, of data of terms that could represent where one might be at in a pregnancy. And then there's something that's very simple, like pregnant, not pregnant. So There's different value sets depending on what the use case is that that value set serves. And so that's one of the reasons, and this is another, this is what Mark is presenting is another set of terms that, that could be useful. It's sort of an in-between set of like not super specific, but also not very generic. So the recommendation could specifically recommend a particular value set, this one or something else.
So does anyone feel strongly that we should wade into the waters of value sets in our recommendation, or could we simply say, yes, this is great, let's move it forward and wait for more commentary to come in from the community? Arian?
I'm basically having the same conceptual confusion that I'm having for medications and for lab results. Are we saying that for pregnancy status, there's an implied ontology that may be relatively sophisticated for capturing pregnancy status, including intent, including use of contraception, including et cetera, that are applicable for multiple conditions? Or are we saying that we should confine ourselves solely to the Zika case and confine ourselves to pregnancy status for Zika screening? Or are we basically being silent on ontology, making a recommendation that pregnancy status go forward and leave it to the community to work out the implied ontology?
I mean, I'll respond. I don't think there's anything about this recommendation or the state element that's specific to Zika, even though that was the experience that, you know, led to its submission. Yes, thank you, Mark. There's clearly this is relevant. I think the key question is simply: do we include in our recommendation a suggested value set, or do we leave it up to the industry to work on that and maybe bring one forward through their commentary?
Got it. So I think what we're saying is, despite that it came from CDC specifically for Zika, we're not limiting ourselves to the Zika use case. We're also not going to point to a specific value set or ontology because we don't know what that is. We're suggesting that pregnancy status be added, and in the period of time between V3, finalization and inclusion via the process, the standards development process, that industry coalesce on a recommended ontology and set of value sets. Is that right?
I like it. I'm trying to capture it. So does anyone feel uncomfortable with simply recommending this move forward? Perhaps with a suggestion to ONC that they work with the community to bring in value set recommendations in the future. All right, so we're going to move this forward.
And Stephen, I'm happy to help. I've been consulting with some people about this too. So if it's useful to ONC.
Wonderful. Yeah, anybody who wants to help on the wording of these recommendations between now and next Tuesday, and I literally mean next Tuesday, not in the figurative way that's sometimes used, please do so. All right. So that was pregnancy. And then I think you wanted to go to health insurance, number 19 that we've touched
Correct.
On in the past.
Correct.
We're almost at public comment.
We are. Well, I think the summary on item 19 was that we recommended it in prior years. Somebody sorted. So all
and continue to do so.
Yeah. So I guess
I got it. I got it. Hang on.
Okay. Yeah, you did the sort deal. The filter.
Yeah,
filter deal.
I got it. Cool.
So I think that's Stephen, you're right. That's the basic summary. It was a priority last year. We think it's a priority this year. Please include it.
Okay, so hold that thought. We'll come back to that if there's time after public comment. Let's cut to public comment.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. We're going to now open up our call to the public for any comments. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be just on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. Let's take a look to see if we have any public comments. I'm not seeing public comments, so I'll turn it back to our co-chairs. Thank you.
Excellent. And again, I really appreciate the tremendous engagement the public has given us in the chat. I haven't personally been able to monitor every piece of it as we've gone along, so look forward to reading it once we get it out.
Even I'm told there is a public comment.
Oh, good. Did we get one? Mike, is there a public comment?
Yeah, sorry, I was just trying to take myself off mute. We have Ulrich Merrick. You can go ahead for 3 minutes.
Hey, this is Ricky Merrick with the Association of Public Health Laboratory. Just wanted to thank you for considering adding those lab data elements. I've been trying to get those in for a while because they're, you know, essential to making lab data interoperable. So just wanted to say that out loud. Left plenty of comments in the chat.
Thank you so much, Ricky. That's very helpful. Anything else come up? All right. All right. So we were just talking about health insurance. Can we pull that back up, Al, entry number 19, just so that we can get clarity on that. This is health insurance information. Is the data class and coverage status type, relationship to subscriber member. Looks like Al, somebody renamed column E, which needs to be changed back to data class.
No, it's just how I can sort it, Stephen. But E is data class.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. Anyway, so this again, the recommendation is to include this in USCDI v3. It was recommended previously. It is at level 2. Anybody disagree with that as a part of our work group output? All right. We will include that. And then I don't think it makes sense for us to dive into anything new at this juncture, but what we have left is there was a recommendation, which is entry 33 regarding health status and whether it should be brought over as ONC had suggested or left back where it was.
Yeah. Hey, sorry. I just noted Hans's comments on coverage type, and it occurs to me that in the same way that we just decided for pregnancy status relative to coverage type, we may want to include coverage type as part of our coverage recommendations and make recommendations to ONC that they work with NCPDP, X12 or WED, X12 and HL7 to reconcile the vocabulary for coverage type.
So that's number 20, correct?
That's number 20, yep.
All right, anyone disagree with us trying to include that as well?
It is actually included in the one above that we already endorsed. So I just wanted to note the seeming disagreement between those two and just suggest that we add to 19 the recommendation that ONC work with industry to reconcile the vocabulary set.
Perfect. So we invite people to continue to interact with the spreadsheet. We will come back to number 33 around health status. We'll come back to number 70, which captures the recommendation that we heard a couple of weeks ago to include the ICF as a harmonized standard. And then we are going to invite both Clem and Hans to take the mic for a little while to work us through some of the recommendations that they felt were worth capturing. What is our timing now to finish up our recommendations? Can you remind us, Mike or Al?
We had set the new recommendation cutoff for next Friday. And then the following week, so two Tuesdays from now, would be the last chance the work group would have to, massage the recommendations.
Okay, so our time is short, but I think we're in a groove. Hung will also come back and revisit your recommendations next week and see if we can figure out whether we're going to try to swallow the hairball or just sort of pick a few nose hairs and make progress in that way. Ah. So thank you all. We are at time. I got to go see patients. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.